All right, here we are.
Here, what's up, man?
How are you?
Got a question for you. What's your favorite Google product?
Oh, what a tough question. Gmail?
A lot of people say...
Is that silly? I mean, I've been a power Gmail user for so long, yeah. and it completely reinvented what we think about email.
Yeah.
It's a great product.
Yeah, and it's a stable product, too. I'm always curious what people's favorite Meta and Google products are, because, you know, these ubiquitous companies that touch our lives in so many ways. You know, for me, interestingly, I'm obsessed with Android, I think, and the Google Pixel, the hardware, the actual phone itself, I think it's fantastic. And sort of like my Google Pixel is my favorite piece of equipment that I carry around. But the product that I'm going to say I spend a lot of time on and absolutely love and transformed my professional life is Google Docs. Like collaborative co-drafting on Google Docs is the most seamless, easiest, like, collaborate
if email
all time, yeah. In my perspective, it's fantastic.
If email is up there, Google is number one. Google Docs is a close second. And like you and I have talked about this many times, if we don't have outside counsel that's willing to work in Google Docs,
man,
like,
it's gonna be really tough.
I'm out.
It's gonna be really tough.
I'm out.
It's gonna be really tough. And that's not a knock to Microsoft. It's just like how strong that Google Docs collaboration product is, man.
Microsoft is good too, but the collaborative nature of Google Docs.
I'm obsessed with it, man. Well, speaking of Google.
Yeah. Yeah. We got Keith Enright, the Chief Privacy Officer of Google, with us today. Someone you know pretty well. I've just met recently, but unsurprisingly, it was a very thoughtful, deep, interesting,
introspective, honest, courageous conversation. The theme through that conversation to me was about courage and a willingness to take risks, and I think that's important feedback that I hope any listeners out there looking to make transitions, join the industry, like just do something bold will really, really will benefit from hearing. You know, Keith is somebody I've watched for a long time before I knew him and said, you know, that's a interesting, unconventional career path, you know, and he's a lot of things that I wanted to be, right? He's a policy voice broadly for like the creation and collective understanding of policy issues in our industry. He's a operator and a practitioner inside of Google, making sure that the company is acting responsibly around privacy and other related issues. And he's extremely effective at both. Some people are great at the talking thing. Some people are great at the operational thing. Keith is excellent at both. And you can see this even without knowing him, because you can see the results in the work in the products, and you can see the way he engages externally. When I got to meet him, what I learned was that on top of being just like a great performer, he's a fucking good guy, man. He's a good guy who cares deeply about doing good and about people having opportunities. And I think all of that comes out crystal clear in the conversation.
Everything he said in the hour that we talked to him, hour plus, could be applied outside of privacy.
Correct.
Outside of legal, outside
life.
Of tech. Every single thing he said could be taken by anyone off the street and applied to their lives, and you would have a net positive result.
I completely agree. And, you know, that's a testament to the kind of person he is and evidence of why he's been so successful. And one of the most interesting insights he shares is like, you don't have to do it the way I did it, right? There's lots of ways to be successful. You got to define success for yourself and then be willing to be experimental about how you achieve your goals. And like, if you do those two things, you're going to have a positive outcome. It might not be the one you set out to have. And I think that's okay. But something good's going to happen if you create those conditions around you. And it was a great conversation, man. I really enjoyed it. When we first started this podcast, now like 700 years ago or whatever, you know, when we were talking about it in the idea phase, one of the guests that I always envisioned was him. Was like, at some point we'll get him on here when we're mature and know what we're doing. And like, and you know, like it'll be like a, you know, an important milestone for us. And I think, you know, I'm grateful to him having joined us. But
interesting. Yeah. Interesting about him and a thread that runs through some of the folks that are foundational in privacy right now. The Trevors, Jules, Omer, Tene, these, but like they all give back to the privacy community writ large. And so that is something that, you know, certainly we have a privacy heavy audience. I think they're going to look forward to hearing what Keith has to say about getting into privacy, how they hire, how they think about it, how he thinks about the broader community and how he helps, helps people, get their, dreams, on track.
Yeah, man. Let's make it happen.
Hey, everybody. It's Chris with TechGC. Just a reminder that the 2024 TechGC Privacy Virtual Forum is coming up on March 13th, available for TechGC and Deputy GC members. Request an invite at techgc.co.
Here we are.
We're here. Big guest.
All right.
Big guest.
Big guest. Keith Enright from Google. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Glad to be here.
Good to see you. Where do we start? I think there's a lot of places to go, but one of the things I noticed when the first time we talked, Keith, was you've had the CPO title a long time, going back, past Google and other companies. You must be one of the first people to have it. How did that come about?
I was one of the first, I think. I actually worked for the person that I believe, at least in the U.S., was the first, a guy named Ray Everett Church. I got a job with him when I was still in law school. And me and some of my classmates, one in particular, a guy several a good friend of mine named Michael McCullough, who were classmates together at GW, we had written a piece of work called the CPO Guidelines. And the job really didn't, I think, exist in any formal sense of the word yet. There were a bunch of companies that were experimenting with the role, trying to figure out what it meant. And me and Michael, who were completely unqualified to have an opinion on it at the time, we were just a couple of third year law students. We put together a document that was basically trying to capture, if this job were to exist, what might it entail and how might someone think about the relevant responsibilities for someone who is going to try to take this on?
That's so interesting. How did you and Mac, as he's often known, how did you and Mac come to the realization that we should be thinking about this? Was there a professor obviously you got Professor Solov at GW, who's a known entity in the privacy space, but how'd that come about?
It's funny. It's everything is circuitous for us. I did not know Dan well at the time. We're friends now. Of course, our careers have kind of collided a whole bunch of times between now and then. The professor who was most impactful for me back then was actually Jeffrey Rosen, whom many probably know. He's written some great books in the space. He is a very, very dear friend. Now he's the president of the National Constitution Center. But he had run a legal seminar for upper class law students on privacy. It was a very different thing from the kind of thing we talk about today. It wasn't really all about data privacy. It was more about the way the law was evolving at the time to deal with changes in society. But that isn't really what led to this. I would say when I was in my second year of law school, I was working for LexisNexis and some others. So I sort of was spending a lot of time in the law library, and I registered the domain privacylaw.net. In part just because I was intellectually curious. I thought this was interesting. I was thinking about the fact that computing capabilities were sort of hockey sticking in a really interesting way, and the cost of storage was going down. And I was trying to think what that would mean. So this was not a professional endeavor for me. I was bored. I had some free time. So I registered a domain and I threw up a website that I just started kind of randomly posting stuff in my free time that I was collecting on the internet, just links to stuff that smarter people were thinking and doing at the time. And that took on a life of its own because I had created this website right about that time. DoubleClick had announced, and they were not a Google company at the time. This is pre-Google acquisition. DoubleClick had announced that they were acquiring a company called Abacus Direct, which was a offline catalog marketing company primarily. And the FTC got interested in that, which suddenly, very suddenly, made privacy like a key business consideration in kind of high-profile M&A activity. A reporter in South Africa was writing a story about that acquisition found me on the internet because there was so little on the internet right then that was targeting sort of discussions around privacy law, presumed that I was an expert, so interviewed me about this acquisition. And that set into motion like a series of events that felt largely beyond my control, which kind of sucked me into a career path around privacy, largely just because I had set up a website. And Michael was my closest friend at the time, sort of a dear classmate. We were both sort of thinking about what our careers were going to look like. We were having a bit of an existential crisis because neither one of us looked like your traditional corporate attorney that was going to come out of the legal program that we were graduating from. And this created a platform that both of us ended up launching into interesting alternative careers in privacy.
I love this so much. This is like the butterfly flapping its wings.
I got some key insights out of this. These are some things Keith just said about his law school experience. I was bored. I had some free time. And I launched a website. This is unbelievable. I really like that. No, but I know what you mean. There are some lulls in law school. I mean, you clearly took that lull and you turned it into something really significant for yourself. And I love the fact that it was sort of serendipitous outreach by a journalist in, you know, in, you said, I think you said South Africa, just somewhere random. And then now here we are talking about the journey that took you on, which is a really, really cool and interesting one. That's amazing to me. And you were in your second year of law school, right? I mean, that's incredible. That's really cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, we can go as far into this as you guys would like, but it has been so interesting for me, humbling on the one hand, and also just a reminder that like serendipity is huge. Yeah. Hustle is everything, right? Like I was definitely not the smartest person in my law school class. I was not sort of the best prepared to do the things we were going to do there, but I definitely had a lot of hustle. I wanted an alternative career. I was not really interested in traditional legal practice. And fast forward a bunch of years later, you know, a few years ago, I had the immense privilege of delivering the commencement address at my law school. I mean, talk about a humbling experience. When I graduated from GW, Chief Justice Rehnquist was our commencement speaker. And here I am sort of years later, and I'm standing up at that podium, not really feeling like that was an earned privilege by any measure. And the message I was giving was exactly this, like, speaking to these law students, you have this incredible opportunity to design the life that you want. You have this incredible skill set that you've gathered across law school. Don't feel compelled to be the professional or the lawyer or the person that anyone around you is telling you you ought to be. Like, dream big, change the world, and you know, figure out what your calling is and what you're passionate about and run at it, because that certainly worked out super well for me.
One of the challenges with privacy today, I think, is that it's really difficult for somebody to come out of law school with zero experience and get into the field. And I think, like, I wanted to ask you about that because of the things you just said in speaking to students like that. And so many of us, so many people reach out to us now and ask the same questions. And I have difficulty answering that question for people. You know, you're obviously presiding over a big legal department. Our big privacy team and a group of lawyers and privacy pros. So, like, how you think about that from your, I think probably your role today versus like when you came up, what can we do? Like, how can we help people? Because more and more people want to get in on the ground floor now. We didn't have that problem when we started.
You know, it's so interesting when I get this question literally every day. How do I do what you did and get the job that you have? And my response is typically take a beat, slow down, like back up for a second. I never really set out to have this sort of massive career in privacy. While I always thought it was intellectually interesting, as I said, that's sort of why I was drawn to it. I didn't have some grand design, some grand plan that I executed to with precision and diligence that got me from where I was to where I am. When I was in law school, I was realizing I didn't really want to do thousands of hours of doc review at a big law firm in a windowless office somewhere in Manhattan or DC. And that panic drove me to think about what I could do that would create a different experience and still create opportunity for me. And I realized, I think the one thing I got right very early on was I began investing maniacally in my social graph. Right. So at the time, the big opportunities that I saw, which were opaque and non-obvious, were the American Bar Association had a science and technology division that was doing what I thought was really interesting, nerdy stuff at the time around encryption, public key infrastructure, things that I thought, digital contracts, electronic signatures. I saw technology evolving in ways that I thought were going to fundamentally change the way that businesses operated, and that there was going to be opportunity for lawyers who were ahead of the curve in understanding those technologies to counsel clients in ways that was just not going to be sort of, again, traditional legal advisors with this sort of slow professional trajectory. So I showed up for every one of those conversations when I was in law school. I was the youngest person, typically the earliest in my legal career. And I was just offering to do whatever could be done. Like I would do research, I would do editing, I would make coffee, like whatever it was that the sort of more established folks in the room needed done. And I built a social graph. I made friends. And I demonstrated, I think, to people that I was willing to do whatever I had to be useful and to add value. And it wasn't transactional. I wasn't looking to trade favors with people because I had nothing really of material value to trade with these folks. I just wanted to distinguish myself as a hard worker who was had an affection for technology and was thinking about this stuff a little bit differently. And that paid dividends like over and over and over again. It carried me into the room with people like Ron Plesser, that some of you may remember, sort of an early titan in this legal practice. Lots of folks like that, that I just had the immense privilege of finding myself in the room with, and they were very gracious. They were generous with their time. And all of that created opportunity for me. So when I have people today come to me asking, how can I build a career that looks like yours? I tend to encourage people, don't be myopic. Like if you're interested in privacy, go ahead. There's a bunch of advice I can give you as to how to be a great privacy lawyer. But if you're interested in having a non-traditional career, and what you're really looking for is novelty, velocity, the potential for asymmetric growth, and you're willing to leverage risk, which is what I did, right? I surrendered the security of a big law firm job to take bigger risks, to become hyper specialized. And there were significant bumps in the road. Like that risk was realized a few times, but I was trading on that risk in order to realize what I saw as being a greater opportunity. And it worked out for me. I think those opportunities are there for people now. Like today, right now, in this moment, the analog to privacy for a lawyer, I would say, is absolutely AI, right? It is. Everyone knows it's going to be an extraordinarily big deal. The law is unsettled. Institutions and organizations are going to struggle to keep up with it. It's even bigger. It's even more amorphous. It's even more challenging in some respects. And the upside is a whole lot greater. So if I were talking to a first-year law student today, I would say, don't run around pretending that you're an expert in AI. That won't end well for you. But insert yourself into conversations where people are talking about how the law needs to develop to adapt to the reality that AI is going to bring, and then find your niche, find the area that you are willing to engage with intellectually, that you're passionate about. There are going to be a whole bunch of those. There's going to be really interesting stuff happening in intellectual property, really interesting stuff happening in security, really interesting stuff happening in sort of content regulation and in privacy. Any one of those areas is going to create huge opportunities. But figuring out how to be in the room where people are looking around the corner and looking further down the road, as opposed to just stepping into a big law firm to do doc review for a long time and kind of doing your time for years until you get into the job that you think is actually interesting.
You know, it's there's a lot in there to unpack, and yeah. I thought it was excellent. Here's what's interesting. 8 years after you started, I started. By that time, when I graduated from law school, privacy law was a bit more nascent. It was starting to take some shape. The IPP was out there. Like things were starting to sort of like formalize and institutionalize. Law firms were starting to listen and go, hey, maybe we need a practice area here. My moment was different than yours, but I had to seize that moment. I actually did it differently. I went to government first and took a conventional job and realized, shit, this isn't me. I did that for almost 5 years. And I was more disoriented. I knew where I wanted to go, but I didn't know how. I left and went to a law firm. I did the traditional thing. And within 5 minutes of being at the law firm, I knew, okay, this is not a long-term play. So I have to figure out what to do. So my opportunity didn't come in law school because I didn't make a website like you did, which I think is an awesome thing. You just put yourself out there. I then sort of took a more conventional track, trying to distinguish myself through work, and realized that everybody's smart and everybody does good work. That's not it, right? And then I joined Oracle in-house. And when I joined, Oracle had just bought BlueKai. Like literally the week I joined that company, Oracle bought BlueKai. And the head of commercial legal looked at me and said, "Do you know anything about ad tech? Because we don't know shit." Okay. And, you know, he didn't use those words, but that was basically the sense of it. And the truth is, I said, "No, I don't know much. I had one client and I sort of like know some verbiage, but I'm willing to go and build out this thing if you give it to me." And they gave it to me. They gave me a fucking thing that I didn't necessarily have a strength in, but was willing to risk and do. We ended up buying all of these companies, obviously a huge partnership with Google and Facebook and all the things. But what was interesting is there, out of that came this like data strategy. This was during the times that big data was the big word. Remember this big data? And you know, and the crypto world was starting to like come in. And so I seized those opportunities. To your point, AI is what is nascent right now. I seized those opportunities to distinguish myself in niche areas. And my career went from, you know, kind of traditional track to whatever this is, right? Which it just changed immediately. The one thing that I think is thematic between what you said and mine, I think your success is incredible, is creativity. I think like being creative, your creative moment, your creative breakthrough was that website. That's different than hard work and showing up, which are really important, but much easier to do. That creative moment of yours sort of like made the conditions available to you for you to receive opportunities. That's what it did. And an opportunity came your way, you saw it and you ran with it. That is the advice I give a lot of people, which is keep your eyes out for a moment where you can have a spontaneous or just insightful creative outburst, and do not let that moment pass, because that's your big break. That's your big break. Do you guys
I think that's exactly right, or Pedro?
Am I nutcase here?
No, I think that's exactly right. I will say, again, different perspective, different views on the same thing. For me, I happened to have stitched together some technical skills and abilities in terms of web design because of things that I did in high school when, you know, the internet was still in its infancy, sadly. I'm going to date myself here. And there was this notion of risk. Like, I think if I were going to sort of just spin what you were saying a little bit, I think creativity is essential. I think the willingness to take risks in the moment,
for sure,
is probably the difference maker, because my suspicion is almost everyone, if not everyone, has that creative spark at some moment. I think the vast majority of us shut it down 99% of the time because we're scared, because the world is noisy, because there are other things that just seem safer or more rational, or the people around us are telling us, stay focused, don't be distracted, take the more traditional route. So recognizing that, creating some urgency around execution, and recognizing that deliberate risk-taking all the time is a necessity for outsized success. One thing that I do, you know, I'm very deliberate. I get contacted via LinkedIn or other channels pretty much on a daily basis by people who are asking for career advice, some kind of professional advice or whatnot. I try to set aside time with my admin. I explain to her, please, like, make sure that I am doing this with discipline, where at least an hour a month, preferably more if I can swing it. Oftentimes I can't. We're queuing up these kinds of requests. I won't be able to respond fulsomely to everybody, but I want to create time for these conversations. I think it's an important way to give back. I try to make sure that I'm talking to kind of all different kinds of people from all different kinds of backgrounds in all different stages in their career. I love talking to undergrads. I love talking to law students. I love talking to people from different parts of the world who are trying to figure out, maybe I live in an economy that isn't creating the same kinds of opportunity that someone who's growing up in Manhattan is creating. How do I escape, or how do I find my way in? Like, those conversations are so enriching for me. Like, they're intellectually rewarding. They're philosophically, sort of spiritually gratifying. And I learn a little something from every one of these people that I talk to. The key message is, like, for people not to allow that sort of fear or that general sense that it's all just too hard or it's too impossible. Try to, like, just get past all that and take unreasonable risks, because the unreasonable risks are the ones that are going to return the really outsized returns.
There's so many good points to to highlight in there. I took a call. I took one of these calls this morning, and he asked me at the end of the call, why do you do this? Why are you doing this for me? He's a second year law student and he wants to be a product counsel. And I'm like, that's a pretty long road from second year to product counsel. In particular, you know, we know, and probably our listeners know, like, product counsel isn't a day one job, right? It's probably like you've logged some hours, you know, in a company before, so you understand a bunch of these different aspects. And so I tried to highlight like some of the things you mentioned, Keith. I'm here to help people whenever I can in a certain way to give back, but also like to uplift privacy and to uplift the things that we care about, and to try to help people get those opportunities, because they're really like difficult to come by. And so I was kind of taking a page from your book when I was giving him advice, which is like, open your eyes. It's not, product counsel is great, but like there's a whole lot out there that you can do. And I think we end up giving really similar, you know, generally directionally similar sets of advice, which is show up in those places, show up in the places where those people are going to be having those conversations, be involved in those conversations, just be there. Number one, just be there and show up. And then when your creativity sparks, get in there and be open to it. So these are like really, really important critical points, especially for people that are early.
Yeah. And you know,
like, riffing on that one for just a second, like one thing, because this is like really activating conversations that I've had just in the last couple of days, not putting yourself in a box, like not presuming that there is a certain thing that you are and there's a career path that you've committed to. I know lawyers and legally trained people here at Google who, for whatever reason, either they hit a moment of adversity and that it kind of forced them or encouraged them to take a sort of sideways path, or they just decided they were ready for a change. And they seized that risk and they become product managers, right? Like the legal ladder at Google is a really interesting one, really exciting one, goes all the way up to my boss, the general counsel, Halima, who's sort of this incredible, iconic, really inspirational leader, someone that I really try to model every day. And then beyond her, you've got Kent, but Sundar at the top of the whole organization, like he is a product manager. Like anyone who wants to continue sort of aspiring to the highest attainable heights, you shouldn't be limiting yourself to thinking like, how do I just optimize myself to be a product counsel? Maybe there's a moment where you have that conversation, but I would hope that anyone is going to dream even bigger and not constrain themselves to sort of keep their runway that short.
Yeah. What you just said, like stretching dreams east and west, right? Like is really, really important. You talked about people in non-traditional environments trying to figure out how to tap into the world that we're in, right? I think you used economy as your example, which is like, I'm living in an economy where I don't have the opportunities. Even here in the States, like I think the group I resonate with the most personally, or resonate for the most personally, are people who come from marginalized communities, Latino, migrant families, you know, immigrant families. You know, my parents are refugees. I was born in another country. I'm a refugee. These things resonate with a specific demographic of people that like disproportionately reach out to me and go, I heard about you. Like, how the fuck did you get to what? Like, even product counsel, to the point, is like this thing. Like, how did you even do that? Like, what? How did you get there? Like, you know, and like sharing your story, like the way I know you do, the way Andy does, the way I try to on this podcast, scales us, by the way. Like we can't take 100 meetings a month. So the podcast is a platform to do this more in. But sharing that story, sitting down with someone and saying, man, I'm telling you, I was in that room. They cut my electricity when I was in law school because I couldn't pay for it. Like I remember this. And then, yeah, I was in the army. I had to do that because I had to figure out how to pay for college. And like my number one goal was be the first person in my family to graduate from college. To us now, that seems like a narrow goal. But at that time, that was the greatest goal in the history of my entire lineage and all my ancestors, right? So like showing people that their goal is meaningful, like you did, Andy, and validating it for them, but opening a window towards, hey, that's not the end there, man or woman. That's not the end there. Like there is a whole world that landing in that seat is going to, a world of possibilities is going to open up for you. And I want you to be aware of that as you aim for your current goal, because like, the interplay between those two things is important to Keith's point, which is a risk might show up on your path to that thing you're pursuing that might put you on a different trajectory. And that different trajectory might actually achieve all of the holistic like dreams of yours, whatever those might be. And be like being willing to like allow for the disruption of your plan is really, really important. And this goes to this risk theme that Keith is flagging, which I think is critical.
You know, it's funny. I love when conversations organically make things that have recently happened to you so incredibly relevant. I will not say this person's name because I didn't ask her if I could, and I'm a privacy guy, but I had lunch with someone just the other day, one of my mentors, someone that means the world to me, to whom I credit much of my professional success. And she was telling me this story about how she arrived here at Google. She was the person that sort of hired me into Google. And part of it was as they were recruiting her very, very early, sort of in the company's infancy, and they were trying to build out this legal team. She had a great job at a law firm. She was a rising star, sort of wildly outpacing what most people would expect to be able to accomplish relatively early in their legal careers. But Google was recruiting her for this role. And she had talked about how she's like, well, I want to do this and I want to do this and I want to do this, but I definitely don't want to do that. And she was kind of negotiating what her role would look like. And that became what the product council job is. Like that job didn't exist. And her conversation with a potential employer describing her dream job and what it was that she wanted to do at that moment in her career ended up becoming this template to which thousands of lawyers are now aspiring. Like I love this notion of sort of thinking horizontally about your overall option space and just not getting too linear and not getting too dialed in, because just the amount of opportunity that's out there really is incredible. If you keep your eyes wide open enough.
Especially with AI, right? Like I feel like we're going to redefine so many areas of the business with these things. I think the next product council could be data governance council, or I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
For areas of AI, the law are going to have to be revisited too. I think you made this point earlier, like the implications of AI are sweeping across sectorally and substantively in the law and in business. And there are going to be thousands and thousands of opportunities if you're willing to be creative and non-traditional to seize the moment that we're in and distinguish yourself. Like I think that is it. Absolutely.
So that leads to a really important like question. I think like, so Keith, obviously like, Google's been working in the realm of AI for a while. What have you done and what have you been thinking about? Like, we don't have to go too heavy into it, but what have you been, I'm imagining you've been thinking about it for a number of years and it's changed maybe a little bit recently. So how are you thinking about it now in terms of the role of privacy within AI, which is another, you know, what is that role and how have you embraced kind of like maybe some of the stuff we talked about in your own career and thinking about how something so transformational could be impactful?
Yeah. So first, in terms of my lived experience here at Google, yes, I've had the immense privilege of working for what I believe are probably the most prescient leaders on earth right now, who saw very early on that technology was trending in a direction that was going to create capabilities to improve the human condition and just do incredible things for humanity. I remember the first time I heard Sundar say, we're an AI first company. I remember the first time, and that was novel, right? Like other people were not saying that at the time. Memory is short when you're talking about sound bites and marketing messages and all of that. But like, this wasn't just a sound bite or a marketing message. This was our CEO signaling to our company, the world is about to fundamentally shift. We have an incredibly important role in this next stage of civilization, and we are going to seize it with both hands. So first that, and then I remember the first time I heard him and then others say, this is going to have a more profound impact on humanity than the discovery of electricity or fire. Now, as someone who does, I'm a spokesperson for Google in many respects. I'm a legal advocate for Google. I engage with policymakers around the world. When your chief executive makes a statement like that in a full-throated way on a global stage, that's going to complicate your life, right? When you're a spokesperson for the company, when you're engaging with policymakers, you no longer get to say, just sit back, like we've got this, everything, like it's a long way off, it's going to be fine. Like you suddenly have to deliver. You have to be willing to engage substantively in those conversations. So another phrase you often hear at Google is this notion of being uncomfortably excited. Like, that is something that has defined my experience, my career here in this company. They definitely keep you excited about the possibility for massive impact. But you're always a little bit uncomfortable, right? Because the company is constantly changing. The world around us is changing. Our products and services have sort of profound impact on billions of people all over the world. AI has been the most incredible example of that already. And we are in, you know, the first paragraph of the first page of Act One. There is so much incredible stuff that is about to
happen. I love the AI is trumping fire. Yeah,
fire.
Like, that's
and electricity.
Incredible.
But, you know, but it's not wrong, right? I mean, I said the other day in one of these little engagements I did where I said, like, my biggest concern, Keith, and interested if you share this or think I'm like disproportionately worried about it, both are fine. My biggest concern with how we're thinking about how we're going to govern everything that's happening around, particularly generative AI, which has everyone's attention right now, is this notion that I have inside of me that we're going to create prescriptive regulatory frameworks that might stifle the creation or establishment of the big thing that AI can deliver that's going to actually transform the world. Look, ChatGPT is transforming convenience in some ways, but it's not transforming the world. Solving cancer transforms humanity. And AI is a tool that is making itself available for us to use in that fight, potentially transformatively. I worry about, you know, when we're in this experimentation phase of trying to figure out how to use the technology effectively to solve problems like cancer or climate change or whatever, that we're going to stifle some of that or scare away some really smart people. To your point about courage earlier, scare away some really smart people who say, I want to invest in this, but the hurdles are too high. Do you think about this? How does that apply at a company like Google in your perspective? And how does it apply differently to someone at a startup who's got a really great idea that could change everything, but is worried about what I just said?
Wow. You know, we could fill hours and hours with just sort of this segment of this conversation. I would say I think about this every day, every hour, every waking hour of every day now is in some way engaging with a facet of the question you just presented, right? So here at Google, I think if you watch, you go back when we said we were an AI first company, the various kinds of things our leadership have said, the way that we've rolled out products, we have been committed to being responsible corporate citizens, to being responsible actors in the space. We recognize we are the custodians of profoundly powerful technologies, and we want to make sure that we are bringing them to the market and to the world and to our users in a way that is going to make people's lives better. We're one of the first companies to roll out voluntary AI principles, right? We are our effort at saying we are self-regulating in some respects. We are trying to ensure that we are holding ourselves to standards of behavior that will not only give the world confidence that we're going to be on the right side of history, but will give us that confidence. Those of us who are custodians of this technology, we want to make sure we are on the right side of this and that we're doing this in the right way. As a data protection person, it's interesting. So you watch the way this marketplace has evolved. Not everyone is running the same play, right? We have been very deliberate and very vocal in saying responsibly bold is the way we want to go forward. Yes, we must be responsible because these technologies are powerful and impactful and disruptive, but the boldness is also an imperative. We can't allow our caution and we can't allow our fear to prevent us from making forward progress, in part because we have a moral responsibility to humanity to bringing the benefits of these technologies to people all over the world, and in part because not everyone is going to adhere to the same code of ethics that we will. Not everyone is. And us doing that, like a rising tide raises all ships, we have a responsibility to do what we can to educate the ecosystem and the marketplace and to bring the very best technologies to market in the most responsible way possible, but with an appropriate level of boldness. Now, as a data protection specialist for decades, I think there's a ton of useful lessons that we've learned over the last 25 years about how do you deal with uncertainty? How do you deal with the incredible velocity of technological change? How do you deal with regulatory, legislative, and policymakers feeling a appropriate level of responsibility to protect their citizens, to protect their constituents, to create guardrails so that technologies will be deployed in a responsible way. That's been the job, as you know, Pedro, like for decades, that's what we've been doing. Google search was a massively valuable, incredibly disruptive technology. And we have benefited immensely from a dialogue with regulators and policymakers around the world. The way that that service has been delivered to users has evolved, and we've been educated and regulated, you know, in various respects based on those interactions. The challenge for AI, one of the many challenges of AI, is the velocity is way faster. And the consequences seem to be substantially greater. Much, much, much higher level of disruption, much, much, much faster, which is going to exacerbate the policy challenges geometrically. Now, you've seen me before, you'll see me again. My job is increasingly involving, engaging in conversations that are primarily about AI, but people want to hear what we have to say because there is a sense that privacy and data protection is a significant part of the AI conversation. One of the first things I do whenever I'm on stage in this context is say, you know, my name is Keith Enright. I'm Google's Chief Privacy Officer. I don't pretend to have sort of the AI policy landscape completely figured out, nor do I want to represent myself as the person who's in charge of AI for Google, or the person who has the answers for everyone in terms of how do you regulate AI, how do you constrain AI, how do you prevent all the bad things from happening. What I bring to the table is someone who has engaged in the policy space around technology and data, and I've weighed those equities, right? There is a service that you can launch. Some people may do bad things with it. There are certain mitigations that will inevitably be imperfect. You cannot prevent all bad things from happening without also constraining the utility and the value of a product such that it's not usable anymore. So how do you do that responsibly? How do you create programmatic controls inside of an organization, decision-making structures, accountability mechanisms, so that you can do that with a reasonable level of confidence that you're on the right side of history and that you're doing the right things for the right reasons. I think we've gotten pretty good at that in the context of privacy. We haven't solved privacy. Privacy remains a very challenging policy space and technical space. We've got a lot of work to still do. But yes, and more of our attention is now also being drawn into how do we take the lessons we've learned from that context, apply them to this new AI space, and then be as inclusive as we possibly can be. We need to invite so many people into this conversation, because if privacy regulators and privacy specialists and privacy engineers drive too much of the conversation around AI, we probably won't make the best decisions.
I agree.
We should be one voice in a chorus that should be a very inclusive and diverse conversation with a lot of perspectives, so that policymakers are equipped with sort of the richest possible substrate upon which to make policy decisions.
How do you do that at Google with the scale internally? So maybe I'm asking sort of one click down now, Keith, like internally, lots of important voices, different teams that need to weigh in. You know, how do you organize that just generally
so that it becomes cohesive and understandable and actionable?
Has your company thought about it, I guess, is more
sure,
you know?
So again, like starting with data protection, because that's an area where we actually, we created many of these structures that I think have been modeled across industry based on some of the things that we did. And then it's this sort of launch and iterate attitude, sort of where we continue to try to improve them. Our approach to sort of programs at Google has always been one of continuous improvements. We never think we're fully baked, in part because the threat landscape changes, the opportunity landscape changes, people's expectations change, regulatory expectations change. So in its earliest stages in the context of privacy, one of the first things we did was we created something called a privacy design doc, a PDD. So when an engineer, and I'm going back over a decade now, when an engineer had an idea that involved sort of processing some kind of data, potentially involving personal information, they would have to complete this privacy design doc, which would explain what information were they going to collect, how is it going to be used, how would it be processed, with whom would it be shared internally or externally, how would it be disposed of, how would it be secured, like all of that documentation would be captured in this PDD, and that would have a lifecycle process. So it would, almost like the software development lifecycle, that privacy design doc would follow from initial ideation through original requirements definition. Then as that thing was moved into early design stages, all the way through production, all the way through potentially sunsetting and retirement eventually, we were being thoughtful about the privacy risks, consequences, benefits, and everything else. We were capturing them. And then at various places along that life cycle, we had some consistent stakeholders who were maintaining a view all the way through. And then you were also tagging in people that had relevant expertise for whatever place in the life cycle you found yourself. Now, again, this is over a decade ago. All of those processes have evolved and iterated a bunch of times. Some of that, I think, informed what most people now think of as the DPIA process, right? Data protection impact assessments, things that are required now under laws like the GDPR. We had been building that foundation for many, many, many years before those became binding legal requirements. We've invested in both. So you have the sort of hub and spokes model, right? If you look at some companies, they have a very, very strong central program, command and control, and they try to impose their will on different parts of the business. That wouldn't work at a company of Google's scale in isolation. You can't just have a hub because the ends of the branch lines are too far away. And the signal from the hub, the ability to exert control across a structure as large and as complicated would become very, very diluted. That would create risk. At the same time, you can't become too overly federated in that if you put all decision-making down at the end of the branch lines, you have inconsistent risk decisions taken. You have inconsistent interpretations of legal requirements and policy requirements and everything else. So we're constantly experimenting, adjusting, recalibrating. How do we create a strong central hub in the middle of the program in a central organization with strong, consistent leadership that has 360-degree visibility to the extent that's possible across everything around the organization? And then from that central hub, build out the confederation so that you have subject matter experts living within product areas that have domain expertise, that have a really wide open dialogue with that central hub. So they are very well calibrated on consistent cross-company positions that are being taken, interpretations of law, risk calibrations, escalation paths, all of that. But at the same time, they are sophisticated enough on the individual requirements within an individual product to make real-time on-the-fly decisions to allow innovation to keep happening. You can't always allow for the latency that every single decision within a product is going to float its way all the way back through to that central hub for some central definition and then all the way back out, that it will produce suboptimal decisions and you would just slow down. You would have so much sort of, it would become sclerotic and it would end up failing. So, but
it's just,
I think I've been in a bunch of organizations when you watch this evolve, it's never really static. There is not a correct answer or a perfect design for this. You see organizations end up rotating a little farther in one direction at a certain moment in the organization's history. They rotate back in the other direction. I don't think that's wrong. It's not failing. It's not bad. That's a natural adaptation to changes in the external environment and changes in the internal culture of the company and risk appetites and everything else.
Yeah, I think
there's two things I want to highlight.
Like what you just described, this is something I resist at a company like mine, which is similar to yours, which is this idea that like if we create formalistic structures and just stick to them, everything works great. And that's actually not true, right? And like if you just look to nature doesn't operate that way. Like nature is sort of like formless design. And out of that formless design, you get these amazing outcomes, right? Like evolution, and you get mountains and you get rivers. Like there is, like nature doesn't have a framework, which is if these 15 conditions are met, there's a mountain. There's lots of different ways that nature creates mountains and rivers and streams and trees and whatever. And I think corporations need to think more that way, which is sort of what I hear you alluding to, which is obviously we need some structure and we need some generally applicable frameworks and rules that everyone can sort of rally around to have collective understanding and cooperation, clearly. But we don't need to be so rigid that we put hard borders around that and say that anything outside of those borders is wrong. And that is a tendency in corporate structures, in decision-making structures. And it does create the conditions like where I decide as an operator in those worlds to try to disrupt the bold borders that get created in systems, because I think they do stifle creativity. And I do think that too much procedure and too hardly indoctrinated procedure is a killer for creativity, for innovation, for new ideas, and optimizes for a lot of the wrong things. Will you get a stable sort of infrastructure that everybody can predict and understand? Definitely. But is that the healthiest way to operate as an organization, a company, whatever? I'm not so sure. And I think that's what I'm hearing you say. And if so, I agree with you.
Yeah,
that is exactly what I'm saying. And I would say the one bit we didn't address is, and you need to align all of that with a culture of demonstrable compliance, right? And as you pick on tech industry for a second, as the tech industry, the global tech industry becomes increasingly a highly regulated industry, as sort of more and more diverse regulatory requirements are overlaid onto various parts of our business, you need to preserve that flexibility and dynamism while also producing consistently demonstrable accountability. That is not easy. Yeah. It's extraordinarily difficult. You have, if you look at highly regulated industries, they do tend to become hyper rigid in the way that you're describing. And they evolve into sort of a very different thing. They are not historically super innovative, very dynamic, very fast moving. So I think the real challenge and the folks who are going to lead in our industry for the next 20 years are in sort of in the privacy space and the AI space are going to have this dual sensibility. We understand the need for flexibility. We need to build structures that are dynamic and have the ability to shift and adapt and change. But through all of that dynamism, they're going to continue producing the exhaust, the documentation, all of the things that we need to satisfy an increasingly sort of aggressive and demanding regulatory environment where we are going to be called to show our homework. And reconciling both those things, that's the hardest part of the job. I think it's in some ways, it's going to be the most challenging, the most demanding part of the job. And the folks who are going to be super successful in these very senior roles at these big companies in this next chapter are going to be the ones that can do both of those things really well.
That's awesome. I think I know we're getting close to time, and I really want to ask you this question because the spirit of it is this idea of service and give back that you were talking about earlier. And so I'd like for you to answer in that context. 5 or 6 years ago, 10 years ago, certainly, applying for and being considered for a job at Google or then Facebook, now Meta, and a couple other tech companies was the pinnacle of like opportunity, right? They someone said, "Hey man, Google sent, you know, asked a Google recruiter pinged me in from LinkedIn." That is like a moment of celebration. You know, sure, 10 years ago, definitely 5 years ago. I think that's still true today. And I think that's true for your company and mine and a couple others where like if you join the organizations, you have all of these opportunities you just laid out to essentially determine the future of humanity, of technology, and of our industry. What has crept into people's minds and feedback that I get now is around this. Man, why would I put myself in the crosshairs of working at a company like Google or Meta, where you're going to be under constant criticism, under constant pressure, under constant scrutiny in ways that other companies are not? Why would I put myself in that quagmire when I can go work somewhere else for the same pay, for the same things, and do some of the same work without that scrutiny? What is the value of me facing that pressure? I've got my own answer for that, but I'm really interested in how you think about that, because obviously you still work where you do and I still work where we do. So we think it's important and meaningful. How do you think about that? And how would you tell someone who pings you and says, "You know, I really want to work at Google, but I'm not so sure because it sounds like, you know, you guys are under in the crosshairs of every regulator in the world. And I don't know if that's how I want to learn how to practice." How do you answer this?
So first, just sort of affirming some of the things you said at the front end. Yeah, when I joined Google, I felt like I won the lottery. When they originally reached out to me, it was the first of many years of deep imposter syndrome, sort of wondering how I managed to sort of roll under that gate before it closed behind me. And when I joined, it was, you know, the world was a little bit different. And I think it's worth sort of acknowledging that the tech industry was widely perceived with a presumptive optimism. There was a shared near universal aspiration to go and work for one of these companies. If you did that, you know, everything was going to be wonderful. And everyone was going to perceive you positively and as a force for good in the universe. Between then and now, for a whole host of reasons that go beyond the scope of the 5 minutes we have left to chat, like things have shifted materially and they've shifted differentially. Like in different parts of the world, I'm fortunate to have people on my team all over the world. Their lived experience is a little different based on the market that they're in, based on sort of the places that they do their work and the people with whom they engage. But I would say just about everywhere it has gotten more challenging. I is another conversation we should have someday, which is like, I think there is a general ubiquitous erosion of trust in virtually all things. Yeah. And tech has found itself in that conversation in a way that makes it uniquely challenging for people who are working at tech companies in this moment. People don't always presume positive intent, and sometimes they presume the opposite. And that's hard when I know the people that I work with shoulder to shoulder every day, they are deeply committed, passionate, fundamentally good people who candidly could work anywhere in the world that they wanted to. And they're choosing to do this oftentimes because they believe this is the place where they can have the greatest impact. Now, as much as I think the world has changed, and while I do think the lived experience of a worker at sort of a large multinational tech company has shifted a little bit, I still think it's a great place to work. I still wake up every morning feeling like I won the lottery, even if the job did in fact get harder in some respects. And the way that I identify and recruit talent actually hasn't changed. The things I'm looking for haven't changed. I am not terribly interested in privacy expertise, to be honest. When I am recruiting, if you get an interview for my team, we'll use as an example for the privacy legal team or the consumer legal team at Google, which are the two teams I oversee, I am less concerned about your domain expertise because you probably wouldn't have even gotten that far in the process if you didn't have some indicia of domain expertise. I want to test sort of general problem-solving ability, adaptability, intellectual flexibility, all of those things. But more than anything, I'm looking for passion for the issue space, wanting to be engaged in this incredibly dynamic, fraught, confusing, like sometimes emotional environment where you have a lot of strong views and there aren't always right answers. The ability not just to survive in that environment, but to flourish in that environment, to be intoxicated by that environment and, you know, to feed off of it. That, having done this now for 13 plus years at Google, that is the distinguishing feature that someone who is going to be highly successful over a long protracted career here versus someone who might produce the best memo and might be able to craft sort of the most compelling legal argument in written form, but might not be happy here and might not be the best fit in the long term if they don't actually feel the passion for the issues. The people on my team and the people on the teams that I work most closely with every day, you hear a lot about being on the right side of history, the profound responsibility that we have as a result of offering so many products and services to billions of people all over the world, irrespective of their economic condition, right? We are trying to give people access to the most powerful, life-changing, enabling, empowering technologies that the world has to offer without charging people for them. That is an incredible moral mission in my view. I see it from Sundar. I see it from our product leadership every single day. And the legal team that is supporting those folks needs to believe that they're on the right side of history. Because if you don't believe you're a force for good in the universe, I do not believe you can be good at your job. I don't think that sort of if you're in some soul-destroying function where you think that you are on the wrong side of history, I don't think you're going to perform well sustainably for a long period of time. And I try to build teams for marathons, not for sprints. I want to build teams that have esprit de corps and support each other and appreciate each other and celebrate the collective wins of the group because we are supporting a company that we believe in, that we think is making the world a better place for our families and our children and people all over the world. So I don't think that's changed. We have to support each other more. I think that part of the job is a bigger mandate because sometimes you face more hostility when you go outside as an advocate for the company than you did years ago. But candidly, more often than not, I actually think a lot of that stuff is overplayed. If you engage externally with humility, and if you don't pretend to have all the answers, and if you recognize that your organization has made and presumably will continue to make mistakes into the future, and you invite sincere, honest feedback from people, whether that's a regulator or a lawmaker or someone that you're running into at a cocktail party, if you enter every one of those conversations the same way with a sincere humility and an interest in understanding their perspective, bringing it back into your organization so that you can deliver the best possible product in a way that's going to have the maximal positive impact on people's lives, people are going to treat you well, you know, 9 times out of 10. And the 1 time out of 10 that they aren't, you're going to be well girded against that because you're going to, again, have that confidence that you're a force for good.
This was excellent.
Thank you.
What a great
conversation.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much for being here. Keith, I've known you a long time now, man, which is crazy. And I remember when I didn't know you, I met you through Mac, who we talked about earlier, is a great friend of both of ours. I had, before I'd met you, admired your career and the things you've done. And now that I know you and see the type of person that you are and consider you a friend, I am very grateful for the advice and for the conversations you've had with me on my own path to where I'm at, which is nowhere at the heights that you've been, but hopefully one day can be. And I'm very grateful just for your friendship. And I want to say that here on this platform, because I want people to know that, like, it means a lot for you to be here. But more importantly, it means more to me for the friendship you've shown me over the years. So I'm very grateful.
Thank you for that. Means the world to me. And the feeling is entirely mutual. I am excited about our continued collaborations. I think the next few years are going to create a bunch of opportunities for you and I to do great work together.
Thanks, man. Thanks for being here.
Nice. Thank you guys so much.